William Gibson. Gibson's Iduru, named for pop culture figures that exist only as virtual assemblages of media, deals with issues of human identity and artificial constructions of self and reality. Are humans continuous with the technology they create? Does technology make humans more human? Or have humans become just as artificial as their creations? This novel embraces the notion that we are Deleuze and Guattari's desiring machines, or as Gibson has himself noted, quasi-machines. Gibson extends these typical questions of cyberlit and explores the impact of media today as net-related industries increasingly push for corporate identity online. The following excerpt introduces Chia, a 14-year-old rock fan from Seattle, Rez, the rock star she idolizes, and the Iduru, a personality construct or synthespian that resides online. The female protagonists of this novel have been called post-feminist, a fortunate consequence, Gibson feels, of the intense feminist tendency in science fiction that was centered in Seattle and Portland with names such as Joanna Russ and Ursula K. Le Guin when he began writing in the early 80s. Gibson, in yet another gesture toward contemporary realities, created his Iduru after reading in Carl Taro Greenfield's Speed Tribes about an Iduru that does not exist. A musician who did not exist enjoyed a popular career based on publicity, photographs, and a substitute voice for her songs. It raised questions for Gibson, such as, what if a celebrity you believed in didn't exist? After turning in his manuscript, the author discovered a further irony of an actual virtual Iduru online, Kyoto Date, one of the DK96, Digital Kids 96, created by HoriPro of Japan. Gibson's novel explores the ecology of celebrity, treating the rise to celebrity as an organic process that unfolds in the tabloid media and over the internet. By transplanting characters and technology from the Pacific Northwest to a setting in Tokyo, Gibson globalizes our region, acknowledging the Northwest's connection to the Pacific Rim. The following selections show how art reflects the life of virtual paradises, such as the Walled City and virtual Venice. Rei Toi herself expresses the tensions that arise in determining the distinction between unlicensed and copyrighted materials. She also reflects the loss of history that accompanies an endless flow of images and data, while also capturing the symbiosis that merges online fandom and the otaku, translated as pathological techno-fetishist with social deficit, who deeply care about information. From Iduru, Venice Decompressed. Shut up now, the woman in 23E said, and Chia hadn't said anything at all. Sister's going to tell you a story. Chia looked up from the seatbag screen where she'd been working her way through the 11th level of a lobotomized airline version of Skull Wars. The blonde was looking straight ahead, not at Chia. Her screen was down so that she could use the back of it for a tray, and she'd finished another glass of the iced tomato juice she kept paying the flight attendant to bring her. They came, for some reason, with squared-off pieces of celery stuck up in them, like a straw or stir stick. But the blonde didn't seem to want these. She'd stacked five of them in a square on the tray, the way a kid might build the walls of a little house or a corral for toy animals. Chia looked down at her thumbs on the disposable Air Magellan touchpad, back up at the mascaraed eyes, looking at her now. There's a place where it's always light, the woman said. Bright everywhere, no place dark. Bright like a mist, like something falling, always, every second. All the colors of it. Towers you can't see the top of, and the light falling. Down below, they pile up bars. Bars and strip clubs and discos, stacked up like shoeboxes, one on top of the other, And no matter how far you worm your way in, no matter how many stairs you climb, how many elevators you ride, no matter how small a room you finally get to, the light still finds you. It's a light that blows in under the door like powder. Fine, so fine. Blows in under your eyelids if you find a way to get to sleep. But you don't want to sleep there. Not in Shinjuku, do you? Chiyo was suddenly aware of the sheer physical mass of the plane, of the terrible unlikeliness of its passage through space, of its airframe vibrating through frozen night somewhere above the sea, off the coast of Alaska now. Impossible, but true. No, Chiyo heard herself say, as Skull Wars, noting her inattention, dumped her back a level. No, the woman agreed. You don't. I know, but they make you. They make you at the center of the world. And then she put her head back, closed her eyes, and began to snore. Chiyo exited Skull Wars and tucked the touchpad into the seat back pocket. She felt like screaming. What had that been about? The attendant came by, scooped up the corral of celery sticks in a napkin, took the woman's glass, wiped the tray, and snapped it up into position in the seat bag. My bag? Chiyo said. In the bin? She pointed. He opened the hatch above her, pulled out her bag, and lowered it into her lap. How do you undo these? She touched the loops of tough red jelly that held the zip tabs together. He took a small black tool from a black holster on his belt. It looked like something she'd seen a vet use to trim a dog's nails. He held his other hand cupped to catch the little balls the loops became when he snipped them with the tool. Okay to run this? She pulled a zip and showed him her sand bender stuffed in between four pairs of rolled-up tights. You can't port back here, only in business or first, he said, but you can access what you've got. Cable to the seat back display if you want. Thanks, she said. Got gogs. He moved on. The blonde snore faltered in mid-buzz as they jolted over a pocket of turbulence. She had dug her glasses and tip sets from their nests of clean underwear, putting them beside her, between her hip and the armrest. She pulled the sand benders out, zipped the bag shut, and used her free hand and both feet to wedge the bag under the seat in front of her. She wanted out of here so bad. With the sand benders across her thighs, she thumbed a battery check. 8 hours on miser mode if she was lucky. But right now she didn't care. She uncoiled the lead from around the bridge of her glasses and jacked it. The tip sets were tangled, like they always were. Take your time, she told herself. A torn sensor band, and she'd be here all night with an Ashley Modine Carter clone. Little silver thimbles, flexi framework fingers, easy did it. Plug for each one, jack and jack. The blonde said something in her sleep, if sleep was what you called it. Chiyo picked up her glasses, slid them on, and hit big red. My ass out of here. And it was. There on the edge of her bed, looking at the low-res skyline poster, until Lo noticed. He stroked his half-grown mustache and grinned at her. Hey, Chiyo. Hey. Experience kept it sub-vocal for privacy's sake. What's up, girl? I'm on an airplane. I'm on my way to Japan. Japan? Kiki, you do our Budokan disc? I don't feel like talking low. Not to a software agent, anyway, sweet as he might be. Easy. He shot her that cat-like grin, his eyes wrinkling at the corners, and became a still image. Chiyo looked around, feeling disappointed. Things weren't quite the right size somehow, or maybe she should have used those fractal packets that messed it all up a little, put dust in the corners and smudges around the light switch. Zona Rosa swore by them. When she was home, Chiyo liked it that the construct was cleaner than her room ever was. Now it made her homesick, made her miss the real thing. She gestured for the living room, phasing past what would have been the door to her mother's bedroom. She'd barely wireframed it here, and there was no there, no interiority. The living room had its sketchy angles as well, and furniture she'd imported from a Playmobil system that predated her sandbenders. Wonkily bitmap fish swim monotonously around in a glass coffee table she'd built when she was 9. The trees through the front window were older still, perfectly cylindrical Crayola brown trunks, each supporting an acid green cotton ball of undifferentiated foliage. If she looked at these long enough, the Mumpalumpagus would appear outside, wanting to play, so she didn't. She positioned herself on the Playmobil couch and looked at the programs scattered across the top of the coffee table. The Sandbender system software looked like an old-fashioned canvas water bag, a sort of canteen. She'd had to consult What Things Are, her icon dictionary, to figure that out. It was worn and spectacularly organic, with tiny beads of water bulging through the tight weave of fabric. If you got in super close, you saw things reflected in the individual droplets, circuitry that was like beadwork or the skin on a lizard's throat, a long empty beach under a gray sky, mountains in the rain, creek water over different colored stones. She loved sandbenders. They were the best. The Sandbenders, Oregon, was screened faintly across the sweating canvas, as though it had almost faded away under a desert sun. System 5.9. She had all the upgrades to 6.3. People said 6.4 was buggy. Beside the water bag lay her schoolwork, represented by a 3-ring binder suffering the indignities of artificial bit rot. Its wireframe cover festered with digital mung. She'd have to reformat that before she started her new school, she reminded herself. Too juvenile. Her low-res collection, albums, compilations, and bootlegs were displayed as the original case discs. These were stacked up as casually as possible, beside the archival material she'd managed to assemble since being accepted into the Seattle chapter. This looked, thanks to a fortuitous file swap with a member in Sweden, like a lithographed tin lunchbox, Rez and Lo peering stunned and fuzzy-eyed from its flat, rectangular lid. The Swedish fan had scanned the artwork from the 5 printed surfaces of the original, then mapped it over wireframe. The original was probably Nepalese, definitely unlicensed, and she appreciated the reverse cachet. Zona Rosa coveted a copy, but so far all she'd offered were a set of cheesy TV spots for the 5th Mexico Dome concert. They weren't nearly cheesy enough, and Chia wasn't prepared to swap. There was a shadowy Brazilian tour documentary supposed to have been made by a public access subsidiary of Globo. Chia wanted that, and Mexico was the same direction as Brazil. She ran a finger down the stacked discs, her hand wire-framed, the finger tipped with quivering mercury, and thought about the rumor. There had been rumors before. There were rumors now. There would always be rumors. There had been the rumor about Lo and that Danish model, that they were going to get married, and that had probably been true, even though they never did. And there were always rumors about Rez and different people, but that was people. The Danish model was people, as much as Chia thought she was a snotbag. The rumor was something else. What exactly? She was on her way to Tokyo to find out. She selected low-res skyline. The virtual Venice her father had sent for her 13th birthday looked like an old dusty book with leather covers. The smooth brown leather scuffed in places into a fine suede, the digital equivalent of washing denim in a machine full of golf balls. It lay beside the featureless, textureless gray file that was her copy of the divorce decree and the custody agreement. She pulled the Venice toward her, opened it. The fish flickered out of phase, her system launching a subroutine. Venice decompressed. The piazza in midwinter monochrome, its facades texture mapped in marble, porphyry, polished granite, jasper, alabaster, the rich mineral names scrolling at will in the menu of peripheral vision. This city of winged lions and golden horses. This default hour of gray and perpetual dawn. She could be alone here or visit with the music master. Her father, phoning from Singapore to wish her a happy birthday, had told her that Hitler, during his first and only visit, had slipped away to range the streets alone in these same small hours, mad, perhaps, and trotting like a dog. Chia, who had only a vague idea who Hitler might have been, and that mainly from references in songs, understood the urge. The stones of the piazza flowed beneath her like silk as she raised a silvered finger and sped into the maze of bridges, water, arches, walls. She had no idea what this place was meant to mean, the how or why of it, but it fit so perfectly into itself and the space it occupied, water and stone slotting faultlessly into the mysterious hole. The gnarliest piece of software ever, and here came the opening chords of Positron Premonition. The otaku. Something rectangular, yielding to the first touch, but hard inside, as she tugged it free. Wrapped in a blue and yellow plastic bag from the SeaTac duty-free, crookedly sealed with wrinkled lengths of slick brown tape. Heavy, compact. Hello. Chia very nearly falling backward, where she crouched above her open bag at the voice and the sight of this boy, who in that first instant she takes to be an older girl, side-parted hair falling past her shoulders. I am Masahiko, no translator. He wore a dark, oversized tunic, vaguely military, buttoned to its high banded collar, loose around his neck. Old gray sweatpants bagging at the knees. Grubby-looking white paper slippers. Mitsuko made tea, indicating the tray, the stoneware pot, two cups. But you reported. Is she here? Chia pushed the thing back down into her bag. She went out, Masahiko said. May I look at your computer? Computer? Chia stood, confused. It is Sandbender's, yes? She poured some of the tea, which was still steaming. Sure, you want tea? No, Masahiko said. I drink coffee only. He squatted on the tatami beside the low table and ran an admiring fingertip along the edge of the sandbender's cast aluminum. Beautiful. I have seen a small disc player by the same maker. It is a cult, yes? A commune, tribal people, in Oregon. The boy's black hair was long and glossy and smoothly brushed, but Chia saw there was a bit of noodle caught in it, the thin, kinky kind that came in instant ramen bowls. I'm sorry I was ported when Mitsuko came back. She'll think I was rude. You are from Seattle? Not a question. You are her brother? Yes. Why are you here? His eyes large and dark, his face long and pale. Your sister and I are both into low res. You have come because he wants to marry Ray Toy? Hot tea dribbled down Chia's chin. She told you that? Yes, Masahiko said. In Walled City, some people worked on her design. He was lost in his study of her sandbenders, turning it over in his hands. His fingers were long and pale, the nails badly chewed. Where's that? Netside, he said, flipping the weight of his hair back over one shoulder. What do they say about her? Original concept, almost radical. He stroked the keys. This is very beautiful. You learned English here? In Walled City. Chia tried another sip of tea, then put the cup down. You have any coffee? In my room, he said. Masahiko's room, at the bottom of a short flight of concrete stairs to the rear of the restaurant's kitchen, had probably been a storage closet. It was a boy nightmare, the sort of environment Chia knew from the Brothers of Friends. Its floor and ledge-like bed long vanished beneath unwashed clothes, ramen wrappers, Japanese magazines with wrinkled covers. A tower of empty foam ramen bowls in one corner, their hologram labels winking from beyond a single cone of halogen. A desk or table forming a second, higher ledge, cut from some recycled material that looked as though it had been laminated from shredded juice cartons. His computer there, a featureless black cube, a shallower shelf of the juice carton board supported a pale blue microwave, unopened ramen bowls, and half a dozen tiny steel cans of coffee. One of these, freshly microwaved, was hot in Chia's hand. The coffee was strong, sugary, thickly creamed. She sat beside him on the lumpy bed ledge, a padded jacket wadded up behind her for a cushion. It smelled faintly of boy, of ramen, and of coffee, though he seemed very clean now that she was this close, and she had a vague idea that Japanese people generally were. Didn't they love to bathe? The thought made her want a shower. I like this very much. Reaching to touch the sandbenders again, which he'd brought from upstairs and placed on the work surface in front of his black cube, sweeping aside a litter of plastic spoons, pens, nameless bits of metal and plastic. How do you see to work yours? Gesturing toward his computer with the miniature can of coffee. He said something in Japanese. Worms and dots of pastel neon lit the faces of the cube, crawling and pulsing, then died. The walls, from floor to ceiling, were thickly covered with successive layers of posters, handbills, graphics, files. The wall directly in front of her, above and behind the black computer, was hung with a large scarf, a square of some silky material screened with a map or diagram in red and black and yellow. Hundreds of irregular blocks or rooms, units of some kind, pressing in around a central vacancy, an uneven vertical rectangle, black. Walled city, he said, following her eye. He leaned forward, fingertip finding a particular spot. This is mine, 8th level. Chia pointed to the center of the diagram. What's this? Black hole. In the original, something like an air shaft. He looked at her. Tokyo has a black hole, too. You have seen this? No, she said. The palace. No lights. From a tall building at night, the Imperial Palace is a black hole. Watching once, I saw a torch flare. What happened to it in the earthquake? He raised his eyebrows. This, of course, would not be shown. All now is as before. We are assured of this. He smiled, but only with the corners of his mouth. Where did Mitsuko go? He shrugged. Did she say when she'd be back? No. Chia thought of Hiromi Ogawa, and then of someone phoning for Kelsey's father. Hiromi? But then there was whatever it was upstairs in her bag in Mitsuko's room. She remembered Mary Alice yelling from behind the door to Eddie's office. Zona had to be right. You know a club called Whiskey Clone? No. He stroked the buffed aluminum edges of her sandbenders. How about monkey boxing? He looked at her, shook his head. You probably don't get out much, do you? He held her gaze. In Walled City. I want to go to this club, Monkey Boxing, except maybe it isn't called that anymore. It's in a place called Shinjuku. I was in the station there before. Clubs are not open now. That's okay. I just want you to show me where it is. Then I'll be able to find my own way back. No, I must return to Walled City. I have responsibilities. Find the address of this place, and I will explain to your computer where to go. The sandbenders could find its own way there, but Chia had decided she didn't want to go alone. Better to go with a boy than Mitsuko, and Mitsuko's allegiance to her chapter could be a problem anyway. Mainly, though, she just wanted to get out of here. Zona's news had spooked her. Somebody knew she was here. And what to do about the thing in her bag? You like this, right? pointing at her sandbenders. "Yes," he said. "The software's even better. I've got an emulator in there that'll install a virtual sandbenders in your computer. Take me to monkey boxing and it's yours." "Have you always lived here?" Chia asked as they walked to the station. "In this neighborhood, I mean." Masahiko shrugged. Chia thought the street made him uncomfortable. Maybe just being outside. He'd traded his gray sweats for equally baggy black cotton pants, cinched at the ankle with elastic-sided black nylon gaiters, above black leather work shoes. He still wore his black tunic, but with the addition of a short-billed black leather cap that she thought might have once been part of a school uniform. If the tunic was too big for him, the cap was too small. He wore it perched forward at an angle, the bill riding low. "I live in Walled City," he said. "Mitsuko told me that's like a multi-user domain." "Walled City is unlike anything." "Give me the address when I give you the emulator. I'll check it out." The sidewalk arched over a concrete channel running with grayish water. It reminded her of her Venice. She wondered if there had been a stream there once. "It has no address," he said. "That's impossible," Chia said. He said nothing. She thought about what she'd found when she'd opened the SeaTac duty-free bag, something flat and rectangular, dark gray, maybe made from one of those weird plastics that had metal in them. One end had rows of little holes. The other had complicated shapes, metal, and a different kind of plastic. There didn't seem to be any way to open it, no visible seams, no markings. Didn't rattle when she shook it. Maybe what things are, the icon dictionary would recognize it, but she hadn't had time. Masahiko had been downstairs changing when she'd slit the blue and yellow plastic with Mitsuko's serially numbered, commemorative, low-res Swiss Army knife. She'd glanced around the room for a hiding place, everything too neat and tidy. Finally, she'd put it back in her bag, hearing him coming up the stairs from the kitchen, which was where it was now, along with her sandbenders under her arm as they entered the station, which was probably not smart, but she just didn't know. She used Kelsey's cash card to buy them both tickets. The Idoru. "How do you mean she's here?" Lainey asked Yamazaki as they rounded the rear of the Sherman tank. Clots of dry clay clung to the segments of its massive steel treads. "Mr. Kuwayama is here," Yamazaki whispered. "He represents her." Lainey saw that several people were already seated at a low table. Two men, a woman. The woman must be Rei Tui. If he'd anticipated her at all, it had been as some industrial-strength synthesis of Japan's last 36 top female media faces. That was usually the way in Hollywood, and the formula tended to be even more rigid in the case of software agents. Eigenheads. Their features algorithmically derived from some human mean of proven popularity. She was nothing like that. Her black hair, rough cut and shining, brushed pale bare shoulders as she turned her head. She had no eyebrows, and both her lids and lashes seemed to have been dusted with something white, leaving her dark pupils in stark contrast. And now her eyes met his. He seemed to cross a line. In the very structure of her face, in geometries of underlying bone, lay coded histories of dynastic flight, privation, terrible migrations. He saw stone tombs in steep alpine meadows, their lintels traced with snow, a line of shaggy pack ponies, their breath white with cold, followed a trail above a canyon. The curves of the river below were strokes of distant silver. Iron harness bells clanked in the blue dusk. Lainey shivered, in his mouth a taste of rotten metal. The eyes of the Idoru, envoy of some imaginary country, met his. We're here, Arle beside him, hand at his elbow. She was indicating two places at the table. Are you all right? She asked under her breath. Take your shoes off. Lainey looked at Blackwell, who was staring at the Adoro, something like pain in his face, but the expression vanished, sucked away behind the mask of his scars. Lainey did as he was told, kneeling and removing his shoes, moving as if he were drunk or dreaming, though he knew he was neither, and the Adoro smiled, lit from within. Lainey? The table was set above a depression in the floor. Lainey seated himself, arranging his feet beneath the table and gripping his cushion with both hands. What? Are you okay? Okay? You looked blind. Rez was taking his place now at the head of the table, the Adoro to his right. Someone else. Lainey saw that it was Low, the guitarist, to his left. Next to the Adoro sat a dignified older man with rimless glasses, gray hair brushed back from his smooth forehead. He wore a very simple, very expensive-looking suit of some lusterless black material and a high-collared white shirt that buttoned in a complicated way. When this man turned to address Ray Toey, Lainey quite clearly saw the light of her face reflect for an instant in the almost circular lenses. Arlie's sharp intake of breath, she'd seen it too. A hologram. Something generated, animated, projected. He felt his grip relax slightly on the edges of the cushion. But then he remembered the stone tombs, the river, the ponies with their iron bells. Nodal. Lainey had once asked Gerard de Louvrier, the most patient of the tennis-playing Frenchmen of Tidal, why it was that he, Lainey, had been chosen as the first, and as it would happen the only, recipient of the peculiar ability they sought to impart to him. He hadn't applied for the job, he said, and had no reason to believe the position had even been advertised. He had applied, he told de Louvrier, to be a trainee service rep. De Louvrier, with short, prematurely gray hair and a sun-table tan, leaned back in his articulated workstation chair and stretched his legs. He seemed to be studying his crepe-soled suede shoes. Then he looked out the window to rectangular beige buildings, anonymous landscaping, February snow. Do you not see how we do not teach you? We watch. We wish to learn from you. They were in a DAT America research park in Iowa. There was an indoor court for de Louvrier and his colleagues, but they complained constantly about its surface. But why me? De Louvrier's eyes looked tired. We wish to be kind to the orphans? We are an unexpected warmth at the heart of dead America? He rubbed his eyes. No, something was done to you, Lainey. In our way, perhaps, we seek to redress that. Is that a word, redress? No, Lainey said. Do not question good fortune. You are here with us, doing work that matters. It is winter in this Iowa, true, but the work goes on. He was looking at Lainey now. You are our only proof, he said. Of what? De Louvrier closed his eyes. There was a man, a blind man, who mastered echolocation. Clicks with the tongue, you understand? Eyes closed, he demonstrated. Like a bat, fantastic. He opened his eyes. He could perceive his immediate environment in great detail, ride a bicycle in traffic, always making the tick-tick. The ability was his, was absolutely real, and he could never explain it. Never teach it to another. He wove his long fingers together and cracked his knuckles. We must hope that this is not the case with you. Don't think of a purple cow, or was it a brown one? Lainey couldn't remember. Don't look at the Idoro's face. She is not flesh. She is information. She is the tip of an iceberg. No, an Antarctica of information. Looking at her face would trigger it again. She was some unthinkable volume of information. She induced the nodal vision in some unprecedented way. She induced it as narrative. He could watch her hands, watch the way she ate. The meal was elaborate, many small courses served on individual rectangular plates. Each time a plate was placed before Rei Toi, and always within the field of whatever projected her, it was simultaneously veiled with a flawless copy, holo food on a holo plate. Even the movement of her chopsticks brought on peripheral flickers of nodal vision, because the chopsticks were information too, but nothing as dense as her features, her gaze. As each empty plate was removed, the untouched serving would reappear. But when the flickering began, Lainey would concentrate on his own meal, his clumsiness with his own chopsticks, conversation around the table. Kuwayama, the man with the rimless glasses, was answering something Rez had asked, though Lainey hadn't been able to catch the question itself. The result of an array of elaborate constructs that we refer to as desiring machines. Rez's green eyes, bright and attentive. Not in any literal sense, Kuwayama continued, but please envision aggregates of subjective desire. It was decided that the modular array would ideally constitute an architecture of articulated longing. The man's voice was beautifully modulated, his English accented in a way that Lainey found impossible to place. Rez smiled then, his eyes going to the face of the Iduru, as did Lainey's as well, automatically. He fell through her eyes. He was staring up at a looming cliff face that seemed to consist entirely of small rectangular balconies, none set at quite the same level or depth. Orange sunset off a tilted steel-framed window, oil-slick colors crawling in the sky. He closed his eyes, looked down, opened them. A fresh plate there, more food. "You're really into your meal," Arlie said. A concentrated effort with the chopsticks, and he managed to capture and swallow something that was like a 1-inch cube of cold chutney omelet. "Wonderful. Don't want any of that fugu, though. Blowfish with the neurotoxins. Heard about that?" "You've already had second," she said. "Remember the big plate of raw fish arranged like the petals of a chrysanthemum?" "You're kidding," Lainey said. "Lips and tongue feel faintly numb? That's it." Lainey ran his tongue across his lips. Was she kidding? Yamazaki, seated to his left, leaned close. "There may be a way around the problem you face with Rez's data. You are aware of low res global fan activity." "Of what?" "Many fans. They report each sighting of Rez, low, other musicians involved. There is much incidental detail." Lainey knew from his day's video education that low res were theoretically a duo, but that there were always at least two other members, usually more. And Rez had been adamant from the start about his dislike of drum machines. The current drummer, blind Willie Jude, seated opposite Yamazaki, had been with them for years. He'd been turning his enormous black glasses in the Iduru's direction throughout the meal. Now he seemed to sense Lainey's glance. The black glasses, video unit, swung around. "Man," Jude said. "Rosser's sitting down there making eyes at a big aluminum thermos bottle." "You can't see her?" "Holos are hard, man," the drummer said, touching his glasses with a fingertip. "Take my kids to Nissan County. I'll call ahead, get them tweaked around a little. Then I can see them. But this lady's on a funny frequency or something. All I can see is the projector and this kinda ectoplastic, right? Glow-like." The man seated between Jude and Mr. Kuwayama, whose name was Ozaki, bobbed apologetically in Jude's direction. "We regret this very much. We regret deeply. A slight adjustment is required, but it cannot be done at this time." "Hey," Jude said, "no big problem. I seen her already. I get all the music channels with these. That one where she's a Mongol princess or something up in the mountains." Lainey lost a chopstick. "The most recent single," Ozaki said. "Yeah," Jude said, "that's pretty good. She wears that gold mask. Okay, shit." He popped a section of maki into his mouth and chewed.